darling, what a good boy.
Okay. For those who just heard that remark overseas, that was not the Revertson talking to me. She was talking to a little baby that's here. All right. This is Fundamentals, How Much Longer Before the End Comes, which is the seventh lecture I've given on this subject so far. And this is subtitled Conspiratorial Babylon, Part 3, Yet More Babylons. All right? Yet More Babylons. Last time I gave this lecture in this series, I quoted John Lennon. The more real you get, the more unreal the world gets. Having said that, I want to quote from Hermes Trismegistus, who wrote in the Emerald Tables, "It is true, without falsehood, certain and very real. What is above is the same as that which is below, and what is below is the same which is above." Which is above, yes, to accomplish the wonders of one thing. Try and get your head around this. One author explicates this a little clearer. It says, to effect the wonders of one and the same work, or in order that the miracle of unity may be perpetual. In other words, the universe is balanced perfectly because out there in the universe and here on this earth, there is a principle that is unifying all things. And scientists have been looking for this missing dimension for decades. And indeed, Einstein was preoccupied with it. Hermes also said this, as all things owe their existence to the will of the only one, so all things owe their origin to the one only thing. And thus he expressed the unity of all things. So there is a unity of matter that holds this universe together, a principal law that scientists are trying desperately to discover. Alasdair Wickham, in the Black Book of Modern Myths, fascinating little volume, has this to say, the US military scientific complex is rapidly moving out of its material comfort zone and onto another plane entirely, the spiritual one. Here, their agents trawl the spirit world, encountering angels and demons in their efforts to access information from what they call the Matrix, but which is more widely known as the Akashic Record. A cloud of knowledge, some say it is the sum total of all knowledge, contained in another dimension that surrounds the earth. Now, we are indebted to the mystery schools of the ancient world for the preservation of knowledge, which has formed the basis of our modern technological achievements, which have benefited our global society at many different levels. And we might sort of say, well, we've never thought of it from that point of view. Didn't men just come along and discover electricity? Didn't they discover this? Didn't they just rediscover that? But the truth is, what we have today is a rediscovery of ancient technology that was utilized way back in the days of Noah and previous to that. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that as I go through this lecture. Why should I wait till then? Electricity, I mentioned it just in passing, was bequeathed to us by the ancients. In fact, if you look into the Talmud, it mentions specifically that the temple of Solomon had light that never went out. Noah's Ark had a particular window in it. But if you look very carefully at the Hebrew word in Genesis for the word window, it's actually talking about light. And that light never went out. Rather interestingly enough, when a particular archaeologist was excavating a tomb in Egypt, he was fascinated by the light that radiated in that tomb, and it had been on for thousands of years. Trouble was, he made the mistake of trying to get it off the wall to see how it operated, and of course it shattered.
Same in South America, they've still got the crystal in the museum there in Mexico.
Okay.
It's inside the pyramid of the moon, I think, and Cortez, one of them, put his hand in and grabbed it, and when he took it out, it stopped lighting, and when he tried to put it back in, it wouldn't work.
It's fascinating, isn't it? But clearly the Hermes, I mentioned him earlier, Hermes Trismegistus, he was the one who actually discovered electricity. And I'm going to talk a little bit today about Hermes. He's a very interesting character. And many of the rituals of the Rosicrucian Lodge orient around this personality. If you notice on the board here, I have a header, CIA's New Terminology for Ancient Occultic Practices. This is rather interesting. Some American scientists have now reached the point where they are themselves getting further exposure, more and more exposure to the understanding that the ancient occultists had. They know about the Akashic Record, trance, astral projection, the astral temple, dowsing, and even scrying. Now, it's rather interesting that they have looked at this ancient knowledge and they have reconstituted the terminology involved with these practices. The Akashic Record of the lodges, the Rosicrucian and the Freemasons and who else, whatever. They now refer to that Akashic Record as the Matrix. To go into a trance, they call it now a theta state. Right? It sounds very, very scientific, a theta state. Astral projection is bilocation. I love that. Bilocation. You can be here in one form and somewhere else in another form. Astral temple is now called the sanctuary. Dowsing is coordinate remote viewing, and scrying, which of course is automatic writing or looking into a crystal ball or looking into a mirror with a candle in front of that to try and stare yourself into bringing out from that mirror other energies, that's now called written remote viewing. Okay, especially with automatic writing. But it's an official method now for investigators working in these areas of the paranormal for military purposes. And it is heavy. Indeed, scrying, this automatic writing, was brought to perfection by Dr. John Dee, who, of course, was the Rosicrucian court astrologer of Queen Elizabeth I. He was the very first 007, as a matter of fact, John Dee. I'll discuss current US intentions in relation to practical application of this a little later. But, you know, the world we live in is oftentimes at variance with what we normally believe to be the world in which we find ourselves. That's a fact. And the earth in which we live, the earth in which we love, the earth in which we move and have our being appears one way, but it's quite another. I was only commenting the other day when we were going up to South Tweed in the car to Glenis. I said, look around you. I said, it just looks flat. You can understand why the ancients believed the world was flat. It looks flat. Nothing's moving except the clouds in the sky. And here we are on this earth that's spinning through space at a remarkable rate around the sun. There's no up, there's no down, there's no sideways, it's just, there it is. But we have a different perception of that in our everyday activities. And when we have our eyes open, sometimes we're shocked into reality when we see things that are different to what is expected. I remember when my son Amos was a little boy, he always was looking in the sky looking for UFOs. And I remember one particular day, he's calling out. We were downstairs. I don't know what we were doing. Robertson and I and Miriam. No, Miriam wasn't around. Were you around?
Yeah.
And we were hearing Amos upstairs going, quick, come up. There's a UFO. And we're going, oh, that's good, darling. What's it look like? You know. And we just didn't take him seriously. He was going, yeah, quickly. And he got angry. And so I went up and had a look out the window. And there, heading from north to south, was this very, very strange cloud. And it was like a cigar in its shape. But the cloud itself was solid, if I can call it that. And it was traveling from north to south very rapidly through slow-moving, wispy cloud that was going from south to north. It was very, very strange. Very strange. You know, I watched that thing go along until it was out of sight. And, you know, that sort of shocks you into a reality. What's going on out there? There is no possible way that that was a cloud. No possible way.
It was dropping what looked like paperwork, if you recall. And you rang the...
No, that was a different story. That was a different sighting. But, you know, there is another realm to which we're totally unaccustomed. And we're totally ignorant of it. You know, we may have our theories about it all, but, you know, overall, we're still ignorant. And, you know, I'm a child of the 40s. And I will recall the naivety exemplified in certain expressions that I heard growing up by our neighbours, particularly as I was approaching adolescence. Things like, quote, they wouldn't put it in the newspaper if it was wrong. All right, the naivety of the 1940s, early 1950s. Quote, my doctor wouldn't have given me wrong advice about my medicine. He says there are no ill side effects for any of the drugs he prescribes. Okay, or quote, they ought to ban and destroy all German shepherds. The government is right about the danger they pose to the community. All right, and there was a few, you wouldn't know, you're all too young, that way back in the 40s, after the Second World War, there was an absolute set against German Shepherd dogs in this country, and they tried to get rid of them because they were dangerous and they were this and they were that. My goodness me, they're all around now. They pose no threat. Or, quote, Bucky Beaver says, new Ipana toothpaste with added hexachlorophene is good for your teeth. Yeah, sure. Hexachlorophene now is banned because it was causing leukemia. All right? So how many children who are on Bucky Beaver's new Ipana toothpaste are actually now dead? It makes you wonder. But for most people, the world is a very ordinary place. They live ordinary lives, tedious, uneventful, nondescript. But there's another group of people called cryptozoologists, and they know better. They know better. So do amateur archaeologists, parapsychologists, and conspiracy investigators. Look, the Kennedy assassination will not go away, nor will the assassination of Bobby Kennedy. That won't go away. The awful events of 9/11 are not going to disappear. And no matter how some shadowy authorities try to manipulate or downplay or even cover up the monumental evidence of shocking conspiracy, it stares everyone in the face. It's a fact. But most people live in a dream world of unreality. My comfortable world was overturned dramatically one early Shabbat morning when my mother, who was in tears, shook me by the shoulders, woke me up and said, how did you know the president would be killed? How did you know he would be assassinated? How did you know, Les? And she was shaking me, crying almost hysterically. So I was wide awake by that time, Saturday morning, listening to the radio as they were talking about the Kennedy assassination, because I predicted it a long time before. I shared it with all my family. I said, this man will die in office. He's going to be killed. He's going to be shot in the head. And it happened. And I noted it in my personal journal at the time. And it was to be the first of many, many, many prophetic fulfillments that I was making. And my life was full of them, and some of my students are aware of this. It's a quote-unquote gift that I wish I didn't have. And most wouldn't be aware that my mind was professionally studied for a period of over 10 years by people who wanted to know how my brain worked or works. All right? So Switzerland. But I'm not the only one who could make successful forecasts, and I'm going to talk a little bit about that in a minute. But I began to realize that for some reason known only to the heavens, I've been granted moments of insight into a world that many living ordinary lives never witness. Because for some reason, I'm not living an ordinary life. I see things other people don't. I come across the unexpected at unexpected times. And I remember, many, many years ago, I was driving down a New South Wales mountainside right on the border of New South Wales and Victoria. I'd left the motel very, very early in the morning to get to the next town for an appointment, and the whole mountain was shrouded in mist. And as I came down that mountain very slowly, because, it was so precarious, and that particular mountain did not have guardrails on the edge of the road, so I could easily have gone over the edge thousands of feet to my death if I was going too fast. So I was doing about 20 or 30 kilometres an hour down. I was going down this mountain. And as I got to a particular bend, I hit the brakes because this cat ran in front of the car and I nearly hit it, and I screeched her a halt and made the mistake. I put it into park and put the handbrake on and opened up the door and got out to have a look at this cat, because it was no ordinary cat. She was no pussy cat. And from tip of her tail to her nose, this panther was about 2 meters long. And I'm standing outside the car in the mist looking at this beautiful creature, this wild creature, with sort of standing on the side of the mountain at that angle, 45 degree angle, with its left paw bent and its head looking back at me. And I'll tell you what, I suddenly realized, what am I doing out of the car? I'm standing there and it's looking at me and I'm thinking, uh-oh, I'm in trouble. So I got straight back into that car, slammed the door shut, put it into drive, and looked around to see it bounding off up into the trees, up into the scrub. And I drove very precariously down the rest of the mountain to the town that was down there. The town was not awake at this stage of the morning, but there was a police station. I thought, I wonder if anybody's on duty. So I pulled up there and I went into the the office, and there were two policemen there. And one fellow was a duty officer, and he looked at me and said, yeah, what can I do for you? And I said, I felt a bit stupid standing there saying I've just seen a panther. So I said to him, look, if you fellows had anything reported recently, something strange around the mountain. And he just put down his pen and he looked at me and smiled and said, oh, so you've seen it too, have you? And I sort of just nodded. And he said, do you want to make a report out? And I said, no. And he said, frankly, the only people that would believe you, he said, are the people that live around here. He said, no one else will believe you. And that was way back in, what was that, 1970s, late 60s, early 70s. But
it's taken all this time for an official investigation of the Lithgow Panther.
Lithgow Panther, yeah.
There are
sightings all over the place.
There's heaps of video footage now.
Well, what they've discovered, of course, is that after the Second World War, the Yanks, which had panthers as mascots, handed them over to the Australian authorities, and they handed them over to guys to take outside and go bang bang, put them down. The Australians went, we can't do this to these beautiful little pussies. Don't let them go. And those little pussycats became big pussycats, I'll tell you. And of course they are around today, not en masse, but they're around. And
but heaps of them in the Blue Mountains region.
But yeah, well, when you come across situations like this, you are stunned into another reality. You're no longer living this ordinary life. Something happens to you. Something opens up in you. You are now aware or awake to a deeper reality of life. And I'll tell you something. It hasn't stopped there. I was with the Rabbitson and the children in the 1980s, and we visited a deserted swimming hole which was situated as a mountain outcrop in the wilds of the far north of New South Wales. A naturopath had recommended this place to us to go and visit at the time. We'd been living at his property at Bruxner Park near the town of Coffs Harbour, and we wanted to break the monotony of life and take the children on a picnic. So we went to this place called Crystal Creek. Now, Crystal Creek, somebody just said, oh, yes. Well, actually, it's funny because there are so many Crystal Creeks in Australia. I mean, it is a very popular name for everybody uses Crystal Creek. But this particular place was in the north of New South Wales, just up from Coffs Harbour. And it was magnificent beyond words. The whole area was absolutely wonderful and picturesque in the extreme. And from our vantage point, we parked the car and we went up there. We saw this beautiful pool, rock pool, and glistening water, nice and cool.
Waterfall.
Oh, yeah, lovely. And from our vantage point, we had a huge vision of the wilds of Australia right to the horizon, just with a few settlements here and there, but very few. And we had the place to ourselves, or we thought we did. All right, we thought we had the place to ourselves. And distance from one side of the very deep round rocky pool to the other was probably about 50 feet. And our two eldest, David and Rebecca, were splashing around and enjoying the coldness of it. It was a very hot day. As I said, there was a waterfall. And the only way you could get from one side to the other was to go either around behind the waterfall, but that was very precarious, or go around the opposite side, which had a drop, you know, thousands of feet, and very difficult to get around. So the easiest way to get from one side of the pool to the other was to swim across. And clearly it went right under the mountain, this pool, this water. Sorry?
It was just so deep.
Oh, it was very, very deep. Scary deep, yeah. So David and Rebecca were jumping in and having a great time. And they joined me. They swam to the other side. Then they swam back to Glenys. And I started to dive in. And I was jolted back onto my feet. And I was all arms and legs at this stage because I saw right in front of me in that water, 2 feet down, the most horrible creature. I was terrified. I could see under 2 feet down from the water surface where it was this huge creature with a massive grey shoulders and a big head, but no neck. And it had two large round eyes staring right at me, and it had a mouth as big as I'm reflecting on this incident and it's beginning to scare me again. It's really interesting. That's how much impact it had. A saucer, large as a saucer. But it had long, jagged teeth, sharp teeth like razors. And I'll never forget the look on that thing. It was looking straight up at me. And its large, fat body mass without a neck and a large head with two great eyes and gaping wide mouth, sharp pointed teeth. And I had to swim back to where Glenys and the kids were. All right? There was no way I was going to get in that water. What was that thing? I have no idea. And I tell you what, finally it seemed to just sink. Down it went. Well, I was terrified. And to this day, as I said, I couldn't even get the word saucer out now, just thinking about that in reflection. And I actually then...
You practically swam on the top of the water.
Well, Jews are known for walking on water. And I almost did the same at that time. I was never so frightened in all my life, and it seemed like an eternity. Well, it's interesting you say that, because I had searched for years since, looking through books about Australia and the wildlife and seeing if there are any similarities in appearance to this water creature. And then finally, it wasn't until we were here, as a matter of fact. So this is now decades later, and I'm doing some research on Aboriginal Dreamtime legends, and I came across the bunyip. Okay, and the descriptions given by our Aboriginal people of the bunyip. And I saw this one and I saw that one and I was smiling, and next thing I know I turned the page and I nearly fell off the chair, because there it was. There was this thing. It had these great big shoulders, this great big massive head, these great eyes, this great mouth, these jagged teeth, no neck, and it had underneath bunyip. Now, I don't know to this day what a bunyip is, but I tell you what, I've seen one. I've seen one.
It's always said that in that deep pool water, you had to be very careful because the bunyip would get you.
Well, they live in the billabongs, you see.
Children.
They took children. And,
it
just wanted to be friends, yeah, sure.
Would you put it down?
I've heard this story before. Where I lived as a child,
yep.
there was a lagoon on billabong, huge billabong, and there was a story. The people that lived there talked about two Aboriginal men.
Mm.
One swam across the billabong, and the other guy followed him. When the first guy got out, the other guy wasn't there.
Yeah.
The
bunyip, yeah.
The bunyip story is
it's based on fact.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You put it down to a prehistoric animal that survived.
It's just survived under
these conditions.
Yeah.
The
eels that sink back into the dark shadows of the rock, that's what that was doing, and it only came up because there was movement on the top and it probably saw dinner.
Yeah.
So many, I think it was about 3 years after. I wrote a detailed letter to Australian author Rex Gilroy. He wrote a book called Mysterious Australia back in 1995, and I shared my experiences with him, but I never received a reply for whatever reason. But it's occurrences of this nature which can hurtle a person from one sense of reality into quite another realm of reality, and you're never quite the same again. So... the world basically is full of mysteries. It's full of mysteries. And most folk never ever encounter anything like this in their entire boring, dull, uninteresting lives. But as we approach the end of the age, we're going to start to see certain things come about. And these things are going to sort of startle people into a new sense of reality. Remember this. In the first century, well, you can read the documents of the first century in what we call our Bible. And there are angels on every page, virtually. Where are they today? People are beginning to see angels. People are beginning to listen to angels. People are beginning to communicate with angels. People are beginning to see things that are converting them, quote unquote, to Jesus, because they're seeing things that are there 1 minute and gone the next, and other people are seeing them in mass. So we're going to see a lot more of this approach to the occult and to another realm as we get into the end of the age fully. And there's also something else occurring at this time, particularly amongst Jews, and that is the resurrection, if you wish, or the revivification of the spirit of prophecy. That is coming, and it falls on Jews, and they're the ones who share these common denominators. In the 19th century, German rabbi Elchanan Wechsler penned the book Az Arah. That was in 1881. And he was having a whole series of dreams, so he documented them. He saw Jewish people, myriads of them, rounded up. Remember, this is 1881. Rounded up. Herded into large concentration camps and exterminated, with their bodies then being burned. Now, the rabbis at the time didn't like this book, and they told him to withdraw it from the publishers, and they attempted to shut his mouth and bring him into derision with the population, the Jewish population, and also through the synagogues, but he persisted in his writings. Likewise, the Rebbe Zershia of Annapol in Poland in 1771 stated, quote, "We must not stay in this place. Jewish blood will one day be spilt here. I can sense it. I can feel it." The name of the town I'm not even going to try and pronounce in Polish, but the name was later changed to Auschwitz. Now, this was 1771. That man entered another realm. He saw it, he felt it, he sensed it, he was horrified by it. Thank God he wrote it down. Yes?
The night before the Tiananmen Square massacre.
That's right, the night before that.
I'll never forget.
In 1889, the Tzaddik Shenevah said, "Say the Psalms, I can sense that a man who will be even more evil than Haman has just been born. Pray that he dies a premature death. That was in 1889. The date was April 20, and Adolf Hitler was born. A story was written in 1896 called The SS. It was authored by English writer M.P. Scheel. The story concerned a future organization of criminals who were to ravage the entirety of the continent of Europe, bringing it into horror, murdering their victims, and burning up the evidence of their crimes. And you're going to see more of this as the years go on. Chafetz Chaim stated with chilling foresight in 1929, speaking about the Great War of 1914 to 1918, or really 19, when the Treaty of Versailles was signed, he said, "The 12 million dead of the Great War? That was child's play. The real thing will start in exactly 10 years' time." Well, that was 1929 he said that. The real thing did start in 1939, exactly 10 years to the day. The world is full of mysteries. The world is full of conspiracies. The world is also full of ignorance in relation to them. But we're living in a questioning society, an age that is beginning to disclose those mysteries, and it is largely as a result of current mystery schools that some are becoming enlightened to the reality of different levels of knowledge. The mystery schools claim descent from ancient Egyptian lodges. Now, I'm not encouraging anybody to go out and join a mystery school. I'm not saying to people, go join the Masonic Lodge. Don't hear me this way. I'm not saying this. I'm simply introducing a lot of this information into this lecture today about conspiratorial Babylon, because I want to show you just to what extent there are Babylons and a variety of them at this end of the age. Now, very few know the origin of the secret schools or the mystery schools of the ancient world. But they were rife right through the Mediterranean at the time of Messiah. And the main subversive underground movement during that period of Roman dominance was that of the Indo-Iranian sun god Mithra. Very, very conspiratorial, that one. But there are others which later were absorbed into Christianity. And the ancient Babylonian mystery religion launched schools with conspiratorial ambitions and projects through the Samaritans. And in fact, the book of Acts talks about Simon the magician, who was the great one, he was called, the great one in Samaria. And everybody in Samaria treated him as a god. He was the man who introduced a lot of the Babylonian mystery religion and its ideas, which became known as Roman Catholicism down the track. There's no doubt about that. But these schools exist today, especially in the USA, and they are associated with all kinds of other conspiratorial associations and organizations, with people having co-directorships in covert organizations that are not a part of the ultra-paranoid lunatic fringe. They are literally respected government organizations, the RAND Corporation and so forth. And most occultists look to ancient Egypt for the origin of the mystery schools, to a man or another intelligence known as Hermes Trismegistus. I've got him up there on the board. Now please note that he is the child of Zeus and Maia. And Maia was a Greek goddess of dubious reputation, but we celebrate her every May when we put aside a day to honour the matriarchs of our family. And we give white chrysanthemums, and we give white carnations, and we give white flowers to the matriarch. Now, I'm not against doing that. It's called Mother's Day in Australia. But I'm not going to knock that, because there are a few pagan customs I'm in agreement with. I'm in agreement with birthdays. I'm in agreement with a wedding ring. And these are all pagan customs, but there's no overt religious significance to them any more than there's religious significance to Mother's Day. So I'm not against that, not by any means. In fact, we celebrate it in this house. But Trismegistus, that very word means thrice greatest, three times great, Hermes, three times great. And he was he's identified with the god Mercury and the great counselor of the ancient world, Thoth, and of course Horus. And people wonder, because he was the one who actually created the mystery schools, they wonder who he really was. And I'm going to tell you today who he was, because there are a number of people that I know that actually want to become a part of the great mystery schools of Hermes. And I find this very, very alarming. So I want to share a little bit of this today and come to a realization who he was and why we should distance ourselves a little bit from his theology. Again, many Hermeticists who follow the teachings of Hermes will claim that, that Hermes, his writings stem back to ancient Egypt. I'm going to tell you now they do not. Most of them were created in the first 5 or 6 centuries of the Christian era in Greece. And the literature needs to be understood that it had its origins in Greek thought, not in Egyptian thought. I'm not against the understanding the knowledge that's contained within the corpus Hermeticum, if you want to call it that. I'm not against anybody reading and researching and coming to understand that, because this whole work is all about research and education. But we need to realize that the writings were not Egyptian, but were composed in the Greek language and not from ancient lost Egyptian texts, as some claim. In fact, Geoffrey Ash, in the book The Ancient Wisdom, says they were born in the first 2 or 3 Christian centuries under a medley of influences, including some traditions which came from Asia. But there's an exception, and they are the Emerald Tables. Now, to start with today, I quoted John Lennon, then I quoted Hermes Trismegistus from his books, from his writings, the Emerald Tables. And these date way back to 2500 BCE, back to Egypt itself. Fascinating stuff. And it's also intriguing to my mind that this character, Hermes, was very much into alchemy, trying to understand how to change certain metals into gold. And there was a reason for that, desire to be preoccupied with the transmutation of metals, and I will come to that in a second. Okay, in fact, it is rather interesting. There are some students who of the ancient world who question Hermes in his relationship to Thoth. I can understand their hesitancy in so doing, but the Greeks in Egypt came across the temple of Thoth in Khemnu. Now, I'm going to write this up here. Khemnu. That was a temple which they dedicated to Thoth. And there's a reason for that. And I want you to take particular note of the first 4 letters in the name of that temple. Most important to make a note of that. Because the Greeks called that temple of Khemnu Hermopolis. Mm-hmm. I'll just write that up here. Showing an absolute connection between Hermopolis and the temple of Thoth, which was at Khemnu. Alright, indicating that they may have been the same individual. And that's the point I'm making. Some of these schools of esoteric thought claim, without a shred of proof, that Abraham, the father of the faithful, received his teachings from Hermes. And there is an insistence by some students of history that Moses was also an initiate into the Hermetic mysteries. And this is because he ascended Mount Nebo, right, which was sacred to Hermes in the form of Mercury. In the form of Mercury. So, to get to the basics in relation to the identity of Hermes Trismegistus, we need to ask the questions, the question, what do we know about this character? What do we actually know from a study of history about Hermes? Well, firstly, Hermes means interpreter. Interpreter in Greek. In ancient times, he was called the messenger of the gods. The messenger of the gods. He could interpret languages. And he could not only interpret languages terrestrial, he interpreted languages extraterrestrial. In other words, he had contact with the sky gods, which is rather interesting. Keep that in your mind. That's the first point. Secondly, his father was Zeus, his mother was Maia, who gave her name, among other things, to the month of May, as I mentioned earlier. In relation to Maia, this son of Zeus and Maia escorted the dead to a place called Hell. So he had a connection with the area of destruction and of pain and suffering in an eternal sense. Thirdly, Hermes is associated with the Pleiadian star cluster. Right, that's the third point. And in some engravings of the ancient world, he is shown holding a menorah. All right, a menorah with the seven lampstands symbolizing the major seven stars of the Pleiadian cluster. And in fact, if you look in Revelation chapter 1 and verse 16, Revelation chapter 1 and verse 16, which I can't find because I'm in Hebrews. That's very clever. Revelation chapter 1 and verse 16. Well, no, in verse... in verse... Sorry? No, verse 16, I was right. He had in his right hand the seven stars. Now, all the way through the book of Revelation, these seven stars are mentioned. They're mentioned over and over again. Because at the end of the age, there's going to be a whole lot of stuff happening in the Pleiadian star cluster that's associated with planet Earth. Fourthly, Hermes was the originator of astronomy and the god of the ancient Britons, as a matter of fact. He was also known as the son of the sun and the inventor of magic and all the arts and sciences. And he was the most eloquent of all the gods. Now Hermes, if you believe the Greeks, in the form of Thoth, had possession of a recondite knowledge beyond our own standard science, bordering on what we would call today quantum physics and quantum mechanics. Loosely put, quantum mechanics is a subset of quantum physics, all right? Quantum mechanics is the theoretical stuff, and quantum physics includes the experimental and practical and observational stuff. So Hermes most certainly had a knowledge of the illusional nature of the universe, and he wrote about it. And you know what? I agree with him. The universe, as we understand it, as we know it, is more like a dream than it is an Aristotelian model. And I've mentioned that many, many times. But he understood that all matter was essentially vibrational spirit. In other words, energy that moves, that vibrates. And the mystery schools inform us that it was Thoth who invented hieroglyphics, geometry, medicine, music, and mathematics. Now, the biblical revelation and Josephus, as well as other ancient historians, tell us a slightly different story. But this is how the Greeks perceived Hermes in the form of Thoth. Whatever the case, he also knew how to melt metals. And that's a fact. All right. So the fifth point, like many other messengers from the sky, Hermes carried the caduceus. The caduceus, or the caduceus, if you wish, the divine rod. And this is the symbol of medical science today. If you look on the back of a car, you'll see that they've got the caduceus on there, and which is the rod with two serpents going around it. Okay, and these two serpents are intertwined in opposite directions. One serpent represents the negative form, which is the receptive or the female form, and it's given activity by the serpent positive, which is the projective form of the male. But neither are able to manifest without motion or vibration. And the rod or the staff, which is the staff of life, the rod of life, and you'll know Moses had a staff, and all the prophets had a staff, and that had power. That staff had power. And but that rod or staff is polarized and is the neutral center around which the two opposite forces intertwine in their eternal progression of recreation. All right? So whoever the original Hermes Trismegistus was, he was most certainly associated with the occult and with knowledge that came from the Pleiadian star cluster. And there is evidence that does more than suggest that his sojourn was indeed directed by extraterrestrial influence. And it was occurring right across the planet. And in fact, we can date Hermes Trismegistus to the Tower of Babel. We can date him to it. What I want you to make a mental note of on paper is this. Babylon and the entire kingdom of Babylon is nothing more than the material manifestation of the invisible kingdom of Satan. This is what people don't realize about Babylon. They don't realize how Babylon today is in our own world. They think in terms of ancient Babylon. But Babylon is a condition. Babylon is a state of being. Babylon is the reflection, as above, so below, of Ha-Satan's own kingdom. And so tapping in to Babylon means literally we are tapping into Ha-Satan's own kingdom, which is simply the material manifestation of that invisible power. And we will go one step further in our admission and our recognition that as we probe into the Babylonian kingdom, we are literally opening the gates for the demonic powers to come into our world.
Party time.
Party time, absolutely. Party time. You know, it is the nature of Hashem to relinquish control of all that he, she possesses. You see, you can't, if you're perfect, you can't be more perfect than perfect. But perfection is ugly because there's no, it doesn't allow you expansion, it doesn't allow you to breathe, it doesn't allow you to grow. So what God does in his perfectness, in his perfect state of being, is to relinquish what he is. He literally dispels what he is. He empties himself. And this is called in Greek kenosis. I've written it up there. It's a very interesting word. It means to literally self-empty to the point where we are reborn. So God incarnates in all that he, she creates. He incarnates in that. And part of this concept of God bringing himself, recreating himself, reproducing himself in us is the process of getting us to empty of ourselves. So God puts on us the responsibility of praise and worship. And so what does he do? He gives us a whole book of the Bible called the Psalms. And what does the Psalms do? The Psalms are all about praising God. And the Psalms are songs. They're songs. Now, you know, when we had our very first, when we first launched the BRI way back in the day, in 1981, all I ever did was give lectures. And we would have people come and say, look, there should be more to this. This potential is enormous. We need to praise. We need to sing. We need to... And I used to go, no, I don't like this. It smacks too much of Christianity. I don't like this. Or I should say churchianity. So we never did. But then it got to the point where we went, yeah, we're going to learn to do this. And I'm going to learn above all else to self-empty in myself too, because the only way we can be reborn in a real sense is to allow God's Holy Spirit, which is the spirit of music. That's what the Logos is all about. The Logos is all about music. It's a musical sound. Rather interesting. To allow that spirit of God expression. And we need to be able, if we can't sing, if we can't praise, if we can't worship, we need to repent and learn to do it. Learn to do it. Oh my, in the AOG, we learned to praise and worship. Was I uncomfortable with it to start with? You betcha. But after a while, it's like you get reborn. You are self-empty. You're getting rid of the arrogance that says, I am God. Okay? And you're becoming filled with the spirit of humility, where we say, yeah, I am a channel for the spirit of God. Of God is God's grace. Yes?
That transformation.
It is a transformation. And transformation is not just in what we think, it's in what we do.
Yeah.
And it's in our expression of our vocabulary. And allowing the heart to open and be joyous. And it's difficult at first because we are very empirical in our natures. The nature of man. We are an empire to ourselves. The empirical self. It's got to die.
Yeah.
It's got to die. Got to be put out of its misery.
Do not be conformed to this world, but
be transformed. By the renewing of your mind.
Yeah, by the renewing.
And that renewing, the same word as rebirth.
Yeah.
We are birthing a new thing in ourselves. How can we have a new thing birthing itself so that others are attracted to it unless we ourselves are creating a new vocabulary, a transformational vocabulary, both in speech and in song? All right. So it is the nature of God to relinquish control of all that he, she possesses, to seek opportunities to incarnate in that which he or she is birthing forth into this universe. But you know, when it comes to Babylon, it is the nature of Babylon to control all things and to possess all things and to subject all things. This is why in a marriage, one of the hardest, as anybody in here who is married, I tell you what, it's the hardest thing to relinquish control. Why are you laughing, Owen? It is one of the hardest things to do is to relinquish control and to say to the other person, even though you know they're damn wrong, it is the hardest thing to turn around and say, I'm going to do it your way, even though it's wrong. I'm going to do it your way.
It's the hardest thing to say, oh, I
was wrong. No, absolutely. Absolutely. I'll tell you a story one of these days about my honeymoon, my very first honeymoon with my first wife. I'll tell you about that. It's very interesting. but, you know, it's all about self-emptying. That's what this is all about. The Genesis record reveals that cities were brought into existence at the time of the patriarch Nimrod. All right? Approximately, I'll write this up here, 4000 BCE. All right, there it is there, 4000 BCE. That was when the first cities were brought into an existence by Mr. Nimrod. And they were created for a reason. I've just been talking about control, Babylonian control and all of that. And they were created for a reason. Now, historians are generally in agreement with that figure and my statement about cities in the time frame, because they saw, historians recognize that cities did come into existence around about 4000 BCE. The first stage in the organizing of human beings into large communities was initiated for the strategic purpose of control. That's why we have a city. It's to control the masses within borders. And the earlier settlements or cities were walled to keep out predators, including hostile and savage neighbours. All right? Interesting. Stage two from 4000 BC. Stage two was the act of organising robust, youthful adults into armies for the purpose of stage three. All right? And stage three was the subjugation of territories surrounding the community. Now, I'm talking about the post-flood period. I'm not talking about the pre-flood, the pre-deluge period. In fact, if you turn with me to Genesis, you might find this interesting. In Genesis chapter 1, not Genesis 1, Genesis Genesis 4, Genesis chapter 4, and verse 17, the very first mention of a city in the Bible. Cain had intercourse with his wife, and she conceived and bare Enoch. And Cain built a city and called the name of the city after the name of his son Enoch. So it was Cain, pre-flood, that created cities, or at least a city. But post-flood, it was... cities were actually brought into existence about 300-400 years after the flood. It's not very long, which indicates that not all the world was destroyed at that time. And in fact, I can show you evidence from Genesis itself that people survived the flood, not just the eight. Josephus tells us in Antiquities that Cain built a wall around his creation. Now, it doesn't say that in the Genesis account, but history records that he did. Now, according to Diodorus Siculus, Ninus, sometimes called Ninus, Ninus, who was the most ancient Assyrian king, was the first to engage in wholesale warfare with his neighbours. And prior to the establishment of Babylon, he had subjugated the entire Mesopotamian region to his control. Ninus, you might say, well, who was he? Well, as I said, he was the first Assyrian king. I've got so much stuff on this whiteboard now, I don't know where I am. But he was the child of a man called Bel.
Don't rub it out.
I won't rub that out. All right, but Bel was his father. And Hyslop, of course, in the two Babylons, correlates the correspondences of Ninus to Nimrod, of Genesis fame, and tells us that Ninus and Nimrod were the same personage. So if Ninus and Nimrod was the son of Bel, who was Bel? Well, clearly Cush. Cush. And he was the son of Ham and the grandson of Noah. Nimrod was the first king of Babylon, but Cush was its founder. Now, most Christians today and many, many Jews believe that Nimrod founded, created, established Babylon. Not true. Cush did. And Nimrod was simply its first king. Its first king. And if you look at Genesis chapter 10 and verse 10, I want to prove this to you. Have a look at Genesis 10, verse 10. Because it tells us, and again, what it tells us is important. Don't read into it what's not there. It says, the beginning of Nimrod's kingdom was Babel and Erech and Akkad, etc. The beginning of his kingdom. Nimrod's empirical ambitions began at Babylon and spread outwards, but it didn't say, and it doesn't say, that he created Babylon. It just says it was the beginning of his kingdom. In its expansion. There's no hint that he actually founded and established Babylon. None whatever. We're reading that into the text. But it was his father, Cush, who was a formidable ringleader against Hashem in the rebellion against God so soon after the deluge, who both founded and constructed the ancient capital of the world, Babylon. Now the name Cush means confounder. Cush means confounder. And the father of Nimrod achieved his ambition to rearrange and recreate a totally new society, in other words, to confound the existing age in which he lived, replete with a new system of exchange. He created coins. And interestingly enough, historians all are in agreement that 4000 BCE, you find the very first coins. And where do you find the very first coins as monetary exchange? You find them at Babylon. Babylon. And here we are in the end of the age, and we're using coins. We who are supposed to be coming out of Babylon, what would we do without coins?
Get a card.
Well, that's right. We're actually heading now to the to a cashless society, and Australia is actually the very first, is leading the way. I talked about this years ago, but Australia was the test case for the New World Order. And in fact, the test case is absolutely what it is. And we now, most Australians are opting for all kinds of monetary arrangements to be done on our mobile phones, on our iPads, on our whatever it is, using the credit system, using the card system. We don't want cash. Most Australians are going this way. Do you know 20% of McDonald's in Australia are now using it purely cashless system? 20% of McDonald's. The people are using their mobile phones and their credit system to negotiate their way into the buying of a hamburger.
It's something like actually feeling money, though.
I like the feel of money. I don't have it that often, and I like what I do feel, what I do possess sometimes. But it's rather interesting. I mean, even the cashless society is coming so fast, we can't keep up with it. They're getting rid of 5-cent pieces very soon. Right? Interesting. In Australia. Now, that's a sideline. I've got myself off where I'm going. But yes, he created a totally new society with a new form of exchange, which is money, in commerce, in buying and selling, in politics, in land administration, in religion, in morals, in ethics. It was Cush who introduced all of this, and he was known amongst the ancients by the name of, and I'll put this up here, by the name of Chaos, from which we get our word, Chaos, not with a K, but with a C. And small wonder, because he totally revolutionized the ancient world. So was Cush known in the ancient world by any other name, apart from Bel? The answer is an astounding yes. Try Cush. Try Hermes. Here I am getting names back to front. Hermes. Now, Hermes is an Egyptian synonym. Son of Cham, or Chem. I'll just circle it there. Son of. So, who was Cham or Chem? Well, he was Noah's son, Cham, from which we get the word Chama. It's rather interesting. The original Hermes, Trismegistus, was black. He was a black. And Ham means dark. Ham means burnt swarthiness. And Nimrod was known to be a man with dark skin, possessing, and this is correct to say this, possessing Negroid features. Correct, such as those of the Olmec in South America. His rule was global, and the earth's first dictator is depicted in the art of the ancient world from Mexico all the way to China as black. Even the great Buddha statues of China are generally depicted as possessing what we would call celebrated black African features. I'm not being derogatory in any of this. I'm just, and I'm talking about race, we're all the children of God, whether we are Caucasian, black, yellow, brown, or blue. We're all God's kids. But Hyslop gives us some very interesting information about Hermes, which I will share with you. He says the composition of Hermes, now please notice he takes the word, the name Hermes, and tells us that it is really two words, Her and Mes, or Me. And Her is Chaldean. It's synonymous with Ham, or Chem, the burnt one. And of course, this is one another reason why Hermes is identical or significantly associated with the sun, the burning one, the burnt one. So the sun is introduced there, hence the early sun worship of a sun god. He says, as Her, also like Ham, signified the hot or burning one, this name formed a foundation for covertly identifying Ham with the sun and so deifying the great patriarch after whose name the land of Egypt was called in connection with the sun. Now, I've already mentioned about the temple of Thoth, which was at Khemnu, all right, and the Greeks called it Hermopolis, showing the connection between Khem and Hermes, showing Ham. There's a connection there, absolutely. he says, Hyslop says, Ham, or Chem, in his own name, was openly worshipped in later ages in the land of Ham, but this would have been too daring at first, because of the rebellion against God. By means of Her, the synonym, however, the way was paved, for this Her is the name of Herus, or Horus, who is identified with the sun. And it shows the real etymology of the name to be from the verb mes, which is from mesha or mesha, mesh, to draw forth, to bring forth, or, as the Latin word is, extractit, extract it, from which we get the word extraction in relation to genealogy. Aha. Right, penny drops. Birth or descent. And so there is a connection between the generic meaning of this word and birth. Hermes is the son of Her or Ham, the burnt one, that is Cush. So clearly, it was through Nimrod that Satan brought the world under political control. No one doubts that. His whole purpose, though, was to emancipate the world from the rule of God. This was the whole point of his rebellion. To emancipate the world from the fear of God. The fear of God. Why would he need to do that? Because the deluge was still so keenly in the uppermost echelons of thought in people's minds. So it would do us well to remember that political ideologies are the result of religious philosophy. Now, please think about what I just said. Political ideologies are the result of religious philosophy. Look at Nazism. Look at the occult practices of the Nazis in Germany before the Second World War, and even involved in the Second World War. It was a society called the Thule Society, which was an astrological occult organization to which the top SS officers, including Himmler, belonged. And so their political ideology was all based in religion. And even Hitler admitted that he wanted to get rid of the church and replace it with the ancient paganistic religions of Scandinavia. So again, we cannot dissociate political ideology from religious philosophy. Again, I'll be having more to say about that in the next few weeks. Albert Pike, I'll quote anybody. Albert Pike, who was an occultist and the foremost Freemason of his day and age, Albert Pike, made it candidly plain that the great objective of the Mysteries of Isis was entirely political. Its goal and purpose was the establishment of a centralized authority, think New World Order, which would have the very best interests in mind for humankind on this earth. Of course, think Club of Rome. We've got it all mapped out for you. We've got your best interest at heart. It was firstly Cush, then Nimrod and his mother, wife, Semiramis, who initiated the mystery system of Babylon, and it is the contributions made by this pair of sycophants that has become the world in which we live. And that includes our religious institutions we find around us. This is why Christianity finally was subverted and became a sun-worshipping religion. Proof of that? They destroyed the Shabbat and replaced it with Sun Day. The Roman Church, with its little wafer, holds it up, you know. Everybody's got to look at this sun before he places it within the mouth and we consume all the ideology of the sun.
It's always in a container.
It's always in a container.
With it,
yes, but that raises. That's right. Yeah, absolutely. The Babylonian mysteries became the Egyptian mysteries, which evolved into Gnosticism and travelled the distance under a variety of names and appellations through secret societies. You see, few realise that the mysteries were not mysterious truths that had been lost to the vast majority living in the world, except in surviving forms at the hands of an elect. Oh, no, 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 no. They were the rituals. They were the rituals concerned with the sacred dramas reserved for the initiates under the terms of sacred and secret oaths. Not the knowledge, but the rituals, the rites. It is this that made them mysteries. Very few were elected to understand the mysteries. And you know what? That's the counterfeit of Hasatan, because today it is the very few who are called by God to have their minds open to the mysteries of life. They're called the elect, the first fruits. This is the responsibility. What I'm trying to get at here is to get home to all of us, both locally and overseas, that we are conscripted to learn. We are conscripted to be taught. We are conscripted to self-empty. We are conscripted to learn to serve. That's what it's all about. Because there's a world, a new world coming, in which the inhabitants of that society are going to be looking to you and to me for the answers. Some of us have the idea that when Yeshua returns, the whole world will see his kingdom on earth. Flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom of God. It cannot see the kingdom of God.
We're all going to have a lovely time.
We're
going to have to work again.
Isaiah says, you will hear a voice behind you, okay, saying, this is the way you walk your enemy, scaring the hell out of you and putting heaven in its place. When someone wants to, if someone sees a beautiful girl, right, he's tempted to rape this girl. There's no one around to stop it. Amos will suddenly appear behind him and go, this is the way, walk you in it, and he'll lose the erection immediately and restore balance and normalcy to the earth. What I'm trying to say is that we are going to constitute an invisible kingdom. Do you know the word for the second coming of Christ doesn't even exist? It's the word manifestation. Yeshua is already ruling. We just don't see it. And one day he will manifest in the heavens. He will manifest in the air above the earth. And the reason he does so there, and the reason we've got to meet him there, I'll come to that in a second. But the fact of the matter is, we are an elect, and we are here to learn. In fact, the Greek word mysterion, which Paul uses, meant private or secret rites. Do we have private or secret rites of passage? Yes, we have a thing called the Lord's Passover. It's coming up in a few weeks. It substitutes for the original Mosaic Passover. New emblems are imposed on it. We have the baptism ritual. That's a rite of passage. Oh yeah, we have our rites, we have our rituals. Oh, what do we do? And given these facts, we can begin to appreciate and grasp why the vast multitudes were kept in polytheistic darkness, while the few initiates of the ancient mystery religion believed in the existence of one united God. Hence, the emerald tables where Hermes, Trismegistus, or Bel, Thoth, or Mercury, or Horus, or what name do you want to give him? Kush. Believed in one united God. But you know what? That one united God wasn't God. This God was not Hashem. It was Hasatan, channeling his energy through his son, Nimrod. And the entire theology of the cultus oriented around Nimrod's missing penis. And the whole world today, I got to laugh about that. I got to joke about that because it's funny. It's funny that intelligent human beings, men and women, would constellate around the human male sex organ. Now, the whole thing is ludicrous. The naked ape is ludicrous. I looked at myself this morning on the Sabbath when I got out of the shower. I took one look at my naked body and laughed. You too can have a body like this if you abuse it long enough, as I have. The fact of the matter is, we are ridiculous when we look at ourselves. We're ridiculous. A naked ape with, you know, godlike qualities and a penis.
Yeah, but it's all got to do with
we are ludicrous.
The pursuit of ultimate pleasure.
Well, it's supposed to be. So what then of alchemy, speaking of ultimate pleasure? What then of alchemy? You see, alchemy simply means to change things from one form to another, all right? The secret, exactly. The secret societies have always been a depository for knowledge revolving around the hermetic art concerned with alchemy. All right? So our modern interest in alchemical processes was revived in the 8th century of the Christian era. Now hear me, the 8th century. Mainly as a result of European exposure to the writings and teachings of Arabian philosophers who were instrumental in spreading the ideas of Hermes Trismegistus. Blame the Arabs. We blame them for everything else. Why not blame them for the truth? They were the ones that brought it. And alchemy originated not in Egypt, but in Chaldea. And we've got to get rid of this whole idea of the Egyptian mystery religion. No, it was Babylonian. It was the Chaldeans. And it spread from there. And indeed, the whole concept of alchemy was a fire philosophy. All revolves around fire. And as such, even the occult Third Reich made the blunder of attacking Russia. You know, they were literally ruled by the Thule philosophy.
Is that Thule or Thule?
Thule, yeah, that'd be right. Of attacking Russia. They were winning the war. But they had this silly idea that if they attacked at this time, you know, if you watch the History Channel on cable, Hitler made a great blunder. He didn't realize it was going to be snowing in a few weeks. Come on. They knew, but they did it anyway. Why was that? Because they believed that their occultic fire, and to make this more of an imprint, they brought Tibetan monks in, right, to be the vanguard in any assault. Hitler, Himmler, and the others were convinced that their occultic fire would banish the ice and snow, that it would retreat from before them, and their troops would advance successfully toward Moscow, and what they thought would be certain victory by the Germans against their old nemesis, Stalin.
There's a well as the fire potion today referred to as methadone.
Good point. That's exactly right. You know, the power... Yes?
Don't you find then a greater irony then that winter was the harshest in Russia for years?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Stalingrad. I mean, look what happened there. You know, it's scary. Look, the power of electricity was known in the ancient world. It was discovered by none other than Cush, the son of Ham. He used it to transmute metals and in producing the so-called Philosopher's Stone. Hermes was given the credit for writing 42 books which contained revelations concerning ancient philosophical knowledge. Unfortunately, they're lost today. They're lost. What we do realise about the alchemists' interest in gold is the fact that in ancient times, gold was not sought because of its economic advantages, but because of its magical properties. You see, its magical properties. Let me just say this. Thoth was the chief counsellor of the Egyptian pharaoh Thammuz. All right, I've got that written up here on the board. History tells us that Thoth was the counsellor of Osiris. If this is the case, it's a simple deduction to conclude that Thammuz and Osiris are one and the same person. Nimrod. And Thoth is therefore Cush. So, where does that bring us? And I've jumped all over the place in this lecture today. Where does this bring us? I think it brings us to the end of this lecture. I'm going to cut this in two. I'm going to finish this next fortnight. Because I want to talk about, because I was introducing the whole concept of Hermes and Cush and the ancient Babylonian mystery religion, and I wanted to introduce another Babylon, which today has been the recipient of the curse, occultic curse, of the ancient world. And I'm going to talk about America. All right? I want to talk about the good old US of A. And I might probably upset some people overseas on this. And we're going there. Well, hope we're still going. But, you know, it is interesting. We need to leap momentarily into the modern age and have a look at how all of that that's on the whiteboard translates into what we see around us today. So if I was to continue on in this lecture right now, it'll be 7 o'clock at night, and it's already only 4. It'll be 7 o'clock at night by the time I even get to the capstone of the lecture. So I hope you've all taken note of what I've said thus far, because I'm not going to repeat it in a synopsis in 2 weeks' time. All right. So I want you all to do your study, do your reading. Go, if you've got a computer, Google all of this information. Get to know a little bit about the ancient world and the real practices that went on in the ancient times. It is important to recognize that the world of Babylon in the ancient times has been swallowed up with each successive empire. Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, Rome, okay, Britain, and now, of course, the American Empire. That today, all this ancient knowledge that we would say is hocus pocus is actually being utilized by the CIA, utilized by other various American agencies, with our interest as the foremost drive in their political agenda. It's not for them, it's for us, you see. You understand that, don't you? It's for us. They've got our hearts, they've got their intentions are for our well-being, you understand. So the CIA's, as I said earlier, new terminology for the ancient occultic practices. They use terms now like matrix, theta state, bilocation, sanctuary, coordinate remote viewing, written remote viewing. I'm going to show you examples of what these individuals, with our best interests at heart, have actually done in their experimentation to bring us a new world order in the near future, and it's pretty scary. Any questions on any of that?